Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. What do you want the new president to know about you or your community as he takes office? That's the question SDPB and NPR stations are asking listeners across the country this week as we prepare for the inauguration of the 45th president of the United States. We want to hear from you. Send us an email inthemoment@sdpb.org, or you can text us 605-956-7377. That's 956-SDPB. Are you comfortable talking with those whose opinion is different than your own? Is the nation more divided now than other times in your memory? We'll talk about those questions and more today on In the Moment. And we start out that conversation with SDPB contributor and host of the Potluck Society podcast, Hugh Weber, who is joining us via phone from Bismarck, North Dakota. Hugh, welcome back to In the Moment.
Hey, thanks, Lori. It's great to be with you again. Happy Tuesday.
So tell us what you're doing in Bismarck.
Well, we're on the road this week as one of the final exercises in the ODA organization, which creates connections and celebrates creatives in the states that end in OTA, South Dakota, North Dakota, and Minnesota. We're actually filming a documentary. So we started in Sioux Falls this weekend. We've been in Milbank and Fargo and now Bismarck. We'll go on to Rapid City and Chamberlain and Plankinton and back to Sioux Falls for the actual first official meeting of the Potluck Society on Saturday night.
So this is a perfect way to sort of bring those ODA states into this national conversation, national question that we're asking. What do you want the new president to know about you or your community as he takes office? And Hugh, you started asking those questions. What did you find out?
Well, before I asked those questions, I actually spent a lot of time trying to convince people to answer them. It was a remarkably challenging exercise, and I think much harder than I anticipated. Emails, texts, calls, all inclusive. I probably reached out to 20 different people, and while many of them wanted to have the conversation, none of them wanted to be on the air. So I'm not saying that we found the most willing. I think we found representative voices, but it was more challenging than I thought. And a lot of the people we talked to and hear from today mentioned that. But we started out, the first clip I want to play for you, the first people I want to introduce you to are Kylie and Christian from Minneapolis. They're a husband and wife. They're filmmakers and work together as creatives throughout the region. Christian grew up in a rural community in South Dakota, Kylie in Minneapolis. They bring a unique perspective, I think. And that's the thing about all of the people that we spoke with. They have some real nuance to who they are. You know, these are faithful, church-going, but also people that live within diverse community. And we'll visit with Kylie and Christian and hear from them. We kind of jump right in after the question, so you're going to hear from Christian first.
If you could tell the new president one thing about your community, what would you like him to know about you and your community?
Well, okay, so I feel like my answer might be a little, well, no, it's not political or it's not partisan, but you mentioned we live in Minneapolis and there aren't a lot of people in our community who are honestly very happy that he is the incoming president.
I guess I would want him to know he's not Minneapolis's choice. He's not, and he probably already knows that and doesn't care, but the overwhelming sense in Minneapolis is of doom, and that's hard.
The day after the election, I rode the bus downtown to a shoot, and it was the street. It was surreal, really. It was like it wasn't like I was really early in the morning either. It was a normal kind of, there was no one on the streets, and there was like this, everyone just had this heavy, like, oh my God. So I think a lot of people in our community are kind of scared or worried that, you know, about what could happen, you know.
I think Minneapolis is a really diverse part of the Midwest as well. And so I think that what I would want him to know also is that his actions and his words have affected people. And that's a ripple effect. I went to a Vietnamese place to pick up pho for my friend. And I, the day after the election, and the place was somber, very somber. And the owner of the restaurant, when asked how she was doing, she said, "Ask me in 4 years." And this was the day after. This was November 9th. And I was very lucky. I got to spend the day after the election with my good friend and her brand new 5-day-old baby. So I didn't have to be out in the real world. But there were very many tears. Her mother stopped by. We all cried. Her boyfriend was there. We didn't cry with him, but he was not happy either. We had a lot of things to say. And I think I think that it's easy to think someone will just change the second they get into office. So that's my hope. My hope, and that sounds naive, but my hope is that he's great for small business and that he's good for people. My fear is that everything about him that Minneapolis believes right now will be true.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that point that it's very diverse, and I guess I just, you know, I would hope that he would consider that he would consider people outside of his sphere of normal consideration, let's say. I hope that doesn't come across as too whatever, but I guess like my greatest fear would be that his promises are made, and my biggest hope is that the weight and gravity of that position causes some kind of heart change.
So Hugh, what I'm hearing there is, no, go ahead.
I want to point out a couple of things that I think are nuanced, and I think it's easy to focus on the anxiety or the tears or the concern, but there are a couple of things that I think are really noteworthy in that conversation, that even the tone of the conversation is somber, but when Christian starts there, Kylie actually jumps in, and it's subtle, and you might not have heard it, but she says, don't censor, right? Like there's this sense of, like, it might be safer not even to express these things. And yet they weren't prompted to talk about hope and fear. They got there, right? Like, this was a natural evolution. This isn't a tidy conversation that makes for really clean radio, but it is real and it is expansive and it involves some verbal processing.
What do you think the big concern is, that so many people didn't even want to answer the question, and that the first thing she would say was don't censor?
Yeah,
what are they afraid is going to happen by saying, you know, Donald Trump, we have some concerns?
Yeah, I don't want to assign motive to that. I think she sensed in her husband that, you know, he was maybe holding back a little bit and wanted him to offer his full opinion. But I'll say that there is this sense that even expressing the feelings, in some way contributes to the divide. And I want to move to the second conversation, if we can, with Andrew from Sioux Falls. Andrew is married, no children, lived in Minneapolis for a while, grew up in Sioux Falls, and now has moved back. Professional, he is a designer, his wife a veterinarian. But Andrew actually, the conversation starts in an interesting place. And Andrew asked me how it's going. And that's how our conversation begins, is with me answering the question, how is this process working?
It has been fascinating because it has been one of the harder things I've done. People seem to be really resistant to having that conversation.
Yeah, it's a tough thing. I feel like part of it is that everyone's been having these conversations over and over and over and over, you know? So it probably gets to a fatigue level where, I don't know, it's like grief. At some point you just gotta, it just sort of wants, you want to simmer and you don't want to talk about a family member dying and stuff. And that was a grim,
that's pretty dark.
So let me ask you directly,
what do you want the new president to know about you and your community as he takes office?
I think he should know that the people I surround myself with value tolerance and a steady hand, and I think they're proud to be critical thinkers and they're open-minded to new things, but I think the people I surround myself with have seen a lot of progress and don't want to take a step back. So I think people are willing to respect the office and give him a chance to do what he's going to do. But so far, all signs have not been positive or optimistic. But I think there's a sense, at least the people I talk to in my community, that if he wants to be universally loved, you know, he's got an opportunity to do that, because if he fails, we all fail. And so nobody wants him to fail just for the sake of saying, I told you so. So I think everyone wants him to succeed. It's just the people who question whether he can or whether he will. Does that make sense?
There's such a question. I love the, does that make sense at the end, where it's almost this, like, it's this anxiousness to find clarity that I think is pretty beautiful. But the bookend that I would offer with Andrew is Andrew starts by describing this place where we are currently as grieving, like there's been a death in the family. And then he still finds a way to bookend it with hope that says, if he wants to be universally loved, people will give him that grace if he engages communities and if he is president for everyone. So there's something extraordinary in that dichotomy that I think is happening whether people supported the president-elect or didn't. I mean, I the number of conversations I had that wouldn't allow them to be recorded that had some of the similar anxieties despite having voted and supported him actively, I think is pretty unusual.
The question we're asking is, what do you want the new president to know about you or your community? You can send us an email right now, in the moment, at sdpb.org, or you can text me right now, 956-SDPB, and we'll get your comment into our conversation. That's 956-SDPB. Hugh, who else, did you catch up with?
Yeah, the last clip we're gonna visit is a husband and wife as well. They're here in Bismarck, North Dakota, small business owners, both creatives, but also they manage some properties. They are extremely active in their faith community here in Bismarck, and I would say, and I think they actually say it in the clip, they see themselves as non-political people, but certainly see being patriotic and engaged as a citizen as a core part of their identity. So we're going to visit Amos and Carly from Bismarck, and Amos begins as well right after the clip, so he's going to jump right into it.
That I feel like the American dream is still very strong in everyone, and that they have the desire to better themselves and to be the best that they can be. And that's why we're in America, and that's why we stay in America. So I would hope and pray that any administration that is in control of those things would set us up to do that, to help and support us in any way possible so that we can be the best that we can be to serve our country, our friends, our communities. That would be what I would ask.
You managed to cross so many gaps and divides, and I feel like tonight will even be a study in people with different perspectives and
sure.
backgrounds and beliefs.
How
do you talk across those divides? How do you, when someone's different, what are the things you bring to those conversations to engage and jump into it?
Gosh, I just think every person is the same to me. Like, I don't think about, like, status or money or anything when I'm talking to somebody. I just, they're human, and I think I'm called to care about them. So,
yeah,
I think that breaks down walls.
Yeah, I think the greater good of humanity as, I think me and Carly are not so good at seeing things on a national level. We're so good about the person in front of us is our heart so much. So anyone that's within our realm, our heart and our passion is to serve and love them where they're at, no matter what it is, and their specific needs that we can deal with personally. So we're not very political. But I think what causes separation is that people hang out with only people that
are like them.
That are like them, because they're like, well, they think like this, so I don't want to hang out with them. I just feel like, well, that's kind of the problem, because no one talks to each other. So maybe you could help that person, or vice versa.
I did this photo project. Well, my friend in Seattle started
it. Yeah, this
is
great.
But it was about Christian and Muslim women.
Yeah.
So I photographed
a Muslim woman reading a book in a coffee shop, and then I did the same thing with a Christian woman. And so these photos from photographers all over the United States are up in a museum in Seattle. And just side by side, a Christian woman doing one thing and a Muslim doing that same thing, just to show we're all the same.
We're all the same.
You know, we're all the same.
Yeah.
And as soon as you have a relationship with somebody, there's nothing to fear.
Right.
And you just see like, oh, they want the same things that I do. They want to be happy and they want to be loved and safe and have great relationships.
Serve their families, love their friends. I mean, everyone's seeking to be known and be loved, no matter what your background is, you know? And I think if you can break down those walls and realize the heart of every real issue is just to be known and loved and accepted for who you are, and all those little things slowly kind of fade away, and then everything goes up. You know, because you're not thinking about yourself, you're thinking about serving and loving everyone else. So.
Now, I want to be clear, because I think that the clip in without context may make it seem like Carly and Amos are a little Pollyanna-ish, right? And I don't think that's what it is. I think what they're telling us is that when it is local, or even more so when it is one-on-one, that people have a way of crossing that divide, that the divide exists maybe in aggregate on a regional or national or partisan national level. But when it comes to getting through a long, cold winter in Bismarck, you better be able to rely on your friends and neighbors regardless of what their policies are. They simply want to be able to continue to do that work one-on-one. And his hope from the new administration that Amos shared is to say, help us do that. You know, create a context in which we can be good neighbors and that we can love the people with us in you know, through action and deed. And I think there's something stunning about that simplicity. And even in those that didn't want to go on the air, that was still there. You know, their reticence, their hesitation, their self-censoring was because they wanted to be able to get back to having one-on-one conversations and working within neighborhoods and communities, which I think is a foundational thing. You know, I came from a background in political work and actually worked on an inauguration in the past. And I would leave Washington, D.C. to fly to a state to work. And I would have the TV on as I'm preparing there, and I'd hear how divided this country was. And then I would get to Madison, Wisconsin, or Des Moines, Iowa, or Tallahassee, Florida. And I would see people just working really, really hard to get through the day and wanting to make things a little bit better for their friends and loved ones and wanting to be good citizens. And I think that's what we're hearing from the people we heard from today.
The heart of every issue is to be known and loved for who you are. I think Amos said that. So Hugh Weber, I want to say thank you so much for bringing that to us. We still want to hear what you think. You can send us a text at 956-SDPB. And Hugh, you're maybe taking some more phone calls with voicemail as well. Is that right?
Yes. So we set up an unusual thing. I wanted to capture a number of voices. And so if people would call 605-413-1517. That's 413-1517 or 1-866-4-POTLUCK. That's 1-866-4-POTLUCK, which is 476-8582. They can leave a message, and it's simple. It can be brief. We're going to share a clip from Sarah from Bison. It's only a couple seconds long, but she saw a post that I made online, and she wanted to call in and share her perspective on this question.
Sarah from Bison. Your food doesn't come from the grocery store. It comes from hardworking farmers and ranchers. Get to know them and their policies and what they need from you to help you eat better. Thank you.
Simple, to the point. She simply wanted, you know, her place in this world in agricultural context. She wanted the new president and new administration to hear that. And you heard it, even in her answer, was because she wanted them to eat better and Americans to eat better. There was still an altruistic kind of thread to it. So 605-413-1517.
We got to go. Thanks so much, Hugh. Coming up next, A Nation Divided, we talk with Frontline producer Mike Weiser about the new documentary, You're in the Moment, SDPB Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. As the nation prepares for the inauguration of the 45th President of the United States, Frontline premieres a 4-hour, 2-night documentary. It's called Divided States of America. It begins tonight on SDPB-TV at 8 p.m. Central, 7 Mountain, continues on Wednesday night in the same time slot. The program is a look at key events in the Obama presidency and the reverberations of those events in politics, race relations, the economy, and beyond. It also examines the nation that President-elect Donald Trump inherits as he prepares to take office at the end of the week. Mike Weiser is an award-winning writer and producer for Frontline. He joins us now from Boston, Massachusetts. Mike, thanks for being on the show today. Welcome.
Well, thank you for having me.
I have watched all 4 hours of this, and before talking to you, I think I took 17 pages of notes just because it's so fascinating and gripping, and it's a history lesson, really with a micro-focus on the past 8 years. Why is this such an important documentary to look at this week?
Well, it really is an epic story. And just over a year ago, we realized, after covering the Obama presidency for 7 years, what an incredible story it was. And it was the story that we wanted to tell was the story of how Obama came to Washington on a promise that he could transcend the country's divisions, change Washington, and what the reality was of what happened in a country that grew increasingly divided over those 8 years of Obama's presidency.
Now, in South Dakota, one of the first people featured in this documentary is our own Senator Tom Daschle, former Senator Tom Daschle, Democrat from South Dakota. And he has sort of a conversation with Barack Obama about running and not waiting too long to seize his chance. Tell us a little bit about that.
That's right. I think Daschle was prophetic about Obama's chances of running for the presidency. And what he told Obama early on, when Obama was still a freshman senator, had only been in Washington just over a year, he said that if Obama didn't run as soon quickly as possible, that the longer he was in Washington, the more difficult it would be to run for president, the more votes that he would have that people would look at, and the harder it would be to sell a message of change. And I think that what Daschle recognized at that moment when he was giving this advice to an unlikely presidential candidate in Barack Obama was that even then there was a desire in the American electorate for somebody who could come to Washington on a promise of change. And Barack Obama was took that message onto the campaign trail, first in the primaries and then in the general election. And it's a message that in some ways is not too different from a message of change, of dramatic change in Washington that Donald Trump would bring 8 years later.
But even before that, on the other side of the ticket, you had in particularly Sarah Palin sort of talking about the same level of change that we hear from Donald Trump years later. How does Sarah Palin's choice by John McCain really transform the Republican Party at that time?
That's right. It's fascinating to go back now and look at the Sarah Palin's selection as the vice presidential nominee in the Republican Party and what it meant for the Republican Party and what it meant for American politics. When John McCain chose Sarah Palin, he didn't know that much about her. But she represented a strain of populist conservatism that would come to dominate the party in the 8 years that followed. She ran very much on being an outsider. She ran against the establishment and the elites, as she called them. And when you watch her moments in the film, you will see a lot of precursors of the message that Donald Trump would bring, ridiculing the elite media and the New York Times in particular, and just a way of speaking and connecting to people that Trump would pick up on 8 years later. And in fact, when Trump was running and many in the Republican Party would not endorse him, it was Sarah Palin who came out to endorse him very early on.
Is Barack Obama too optimistic, too naive in the beginning as he wins this first election? Is he sort of have rose-colored glasses on at that point?
Well, those who are close to Obama say that Obama always realized that when he came to Washington that bringing the change that he promised would be difficult. But I think that there's no question that it was much more difficult than he imagined or that his supporters imagined. James Fallows in the film tells us that one of the remarkable things about Barack Obama was that he had gone from being a state legislator to president of the United States in just 4 years. He'd become the country's first African-American president at a time when people were telling him that that was an impossible goal. And so he comes and arrives into Washington on a belief in himself, on a belief in the electorate, and a belief that his election could change American politics and that he could actually deliver on those things that he promised, to have bipartisanship in Washington, to achieve big goals, and to transform the country.
Paint the economic picture for the nation when he takes office for me.
Well, he really comes into office at a dark moment in the midst of a financial crisis, at a time when it looks like the country could be entering at least a recession, and if things are not don't go well, something that could be as bad as the Great Depression. And we spoke to his economic advisors, who talked to us about what it was like to brief him during those transition meetings as the full scale of the economic crisis was becoming apparent. And it was clear that one of Barack Obama's first acts as president would be to do something about the economy. And, you know, when we look back on the history of it, that attempt, which was the stimulus program, also becomes the first moment of real partisan division, where the White House is unable to convince any Republicans to go along with the stimulus bill, this massive stimulus bill affecting the economy. So these two things, the dealing with the economy and the partisan polarization, are all coming together just in that very first week of Obama's administration, as it's becoming clear that things are not going to be as easy or as simple as some might have hoped.
What goes wrong in that very first week with a president who was elected on the basis of bipartisanship and working across the aisle, and in the first week that's already in jeopardy? How come?
Well, I think one of the things that Barack Obama did not realize, I think, as we talked to people, there were sort of two things. One was that he couldn't force bipartisanship. Democrats had control of the Congress, both the Senate and the House, so they could pass legislation that Obama wanted. But the one thing that Obama could not do was to force Republicans to go along. And in that first stimulus bill, as they're trying to rush it through as quickly as possible, even then, he and the Republican leadership are already at odds about strategy and about tactics. We spoke to Eric Cantor, who said that from the very first days, they came to the conclusion that this was not a president that they could work with. And we spoke to White House advisors like David Axelrod, who told us that in those very first days they were realizing that they might not be able to work with the Republicans, and it was a pattern that continued throughout Obama's presidency.
This was not a president they could work with. Does that happen every time a president is elected, or was it heightened with President Obama?
Well, there's been a polarization and a partisanship that has been growing in Washington since before Barack Obama's presidency. But the people that we spoke to believed that the polarization in this case was unique. And in the film, we tell the history of some of the key moments where bipartisanship is more than elusive, and the confrontations between the Republicans in Congress and the White House over things like raising the debt ceiling, which was a procedural vote that for many years had been taken without much confrontation. But after the 2010 midterm elections, Republicans saw the debt ceiling as a way to force through or try to force through change that they wanted to see in Washington. And so even these sort of traditional procedures that would go through Congress during the Obama administration started to break down, and the gridlock started to grow. Senator Daschle described it, the polarization, as a monster that had gotten out of control in Washington.
Hmm. If you're just joining us, Mike Weiser is our guest. He's a writer-producer for Frontline, Divided States of America begins tonight on South Dakota Public Broadcasting TV. That's at 8 p.m. Central, 7 Mountain. Continues Wednesday night in the same time slot. It's 4 hours, two nights, 2 hours each night. Really compelling from beginning to end. Mike, I'm wondering, how high are the political stakes regarding health care? Because that's another issue that they're just Democrats pass without a single Republican vote.
Well, that's right. The stakes on health care reform, which was Obama's biggest domestic priority in that first year, were incredibly high. And despite spending almost a year trying to get the legislation through Congress, despite trying to win over Republicans, in the end, health reform legislation known as Obamacare passes without a single Republican vote. And it sets the stage for a lot of what you're seeing right now. Republicans running in the midterms in 2010 and in every election since then have used that partisan passage of health reform as an election issue to promise that they will repeal Obamacare. And you see right now the Congress now in the hands of Republicans with a Republican president entering is dealing with Obamacare. So this what seemed to be this amazing achievement early on in the Obama presidency really haunted his entire time in office and did contribute to the polarization in Washington and in the country.
Let's talk about the word betrayal, because Vice President Joe Biden uses the word betrayal regarding Congress's failure to pass legislation after the shootings at Sandy Hook Elementary. When we hear Donald Trump campaigning, there is this underlying sense of betrayal that the voters that come out for Trump feel betrayed by a nation and by this administration. That struck me as pretty significant, this sense that both sides feel angry and both sides feel betrayed. Did you sort of see that coming out as a theme as well?
I think that's right. In the case of Sandy Hook, this obviously horrific shooting came at a moment right after Barack Obama had been reelected. And inside the White House, there was a hope that finally they might be able to do something about guns. And the president had brought in families from Newtown who we spoke to, and they all believed that this was a moment when Washington would do something about gun control. And when that collapsed, that was how Vice President Biden described it, that the victims felt like they had been betrayed. And on the other side, during the Trump campaign, Frank Luntz, a Republican pollster, told us that many Republican voters and many voters ended up supporting Donald Trump because they felt they had been betrayed. Republicans had been promising for years that they would repeal Obamacare, that they would change the direction of the American government. And despite being sent to Washington and having control of the Congress, they weren't able to achieve those things. And a lot of voters felt betrayed by the establishment and mm-hmm. felt betrayed by the establishment on both sides about not being able to get anything done.
Donald Trump, as president-elect, inherits this country, inherits the legacy of Ferguson. He inherits the Affordable Health Care Act, and he inherits the anger that exists on both sides of the aisle at this point. Are there any early signs that President-elect Trump can somehow build bridges that President Barack Obama could not?
Well, I can't tell you about what will happen or how President Trump, what gestures he might make. But I can tell you that the country that he's inheriting is one that has become increasingly divided and increasingly polarized. And there's a lot of skepticism about Washington from voters and from people who are there, and a lot of feelings of frustration and a lot of fear about the other side. And I think that's what you've seen as Barack Obama turns over his presidency. Barack Obama, whose presidency was premised on an idea of bridging differences between red and blue, between black and white, in some ways exposed those divisions and showed how difficult and intransigent they are. So He definitely faces an uphill battle if his goal is to unify this country. And a lot of that, I think, one of the things that comes through in the film, a lot of that, those divisions, if not began in Washington, they certainly were fed by what was happening in Washington.
Does America want a bridge-building, bipartisan president? Or do they just want someone who's going to stand up for what they believe is right and you know, their issues?
Well, that's a good question. And I think, you know, I can't speak for voters, but I think that the messages that you saw in this election on both sides were really tended to be a standing up for their side, from both the Democrats and the Republicans. And there was not the type of talk that Barack Obama had brought in 2008. In fact, by 2012, Barack Obama himself had in many ways abandoned the talk of at least the promise of bipartisanship, though he still talks about bridging differences. And in his farewell address, he was still hopeful. When he was running for re-election in 2012, he was very much running against the Republican Party. So even early on in his presidency, you know, the hopes for bipartisanship, I think they were starting to realize it was much more difficult than they had hoped.
Mike Weiser is our guest. Divided States of America from Frontline begins tonight on South Dakota Public Broadcasting TV. That's at 8 Central, 7 Mountain. It continues on Wednesday night, also at 8 Central, 7 Mountain. Mike, I appreciate it. So many philosophical and bigger questions. I appreciate you coming on and giving us this much time to sort of ask you anything that we want. So,
thank you for having me.
All right, we'll see you next time. Okay. After the break, South Dakota Secretary of Public Safety Trevor Jones is with us. Stay in the moment, SDPB Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. Trevor Jones is South Dakota's Secretary of Public Safety. He brought 20 years of law enforcement experience into the cabinet position, and he joins us today via phone from Pierre. We'll talk about priorities for the new legislative sessions. Secretary Jones, welcome to In the Moment.
Good morning. How's everybody there?
We're doing just fine. How about you and Pierre?
Just fine. Thank you for the phone call and the opportunity to visit with you today.
Always a pleasure. Let's start out with what some of your legislative priorities might be this session. What are you looking at?
We have not too earth-shattering a task, but we do have five bills that we're presenting through various committees, House Transportation, Senate Transportation, and House Judiciary. The first bill, we were lucky enough to move forward already through House Judiciary. We expect to be on the House floor here shortly. That's House Bill 1028. Which updates some statutes regarding wiretapping to make sure that law enforcement can address cell phones as well as landlines, which we currently can. And then we have a second bill, House Bill 1029. You often see this bill, a variation of this bill, each session, because what it allows the Department of Public Safety to do is to update our motor carrier laws in the state so they reflect the federal regulations and standards that might have been passed through a previous Congress. Every year you see some variation of that, some more lengthy than others, but the changes this year seem to be pretty minor. So we're hoping that one sees the Transportation Committee at some point. Obviously, they're still gathering the schedules and putting those together. So eventually that will venture its way to the docket along with House Bill 1030. That particular bill allows us, the FAST Act of 2015 passed by Congress, does change some vehicle size and weight restrictions regarding to your commercial type vehicles. Mm-hmm. And so what would, again, very similar to 1020, but somewhat nuanced and more detailed, is that allows us to, again, bring some state statutes in congruence with that federal law that was passed, specifically around some heavy-duty record services that might be operating in South Dakota, and also addresses some emergency vehicles such as your fire trucks that might be moving to and from a scene with, obviously, sometimes a large quantity of water. So we want to make sure that we work well with our federal partners regarding what they've done in Congress and that they reflect appropriately here in the state of South Dakota. We also have these next three bills I'll reference is the regarding driver's licensing. We hope they allow for a better experience for the driver's license holder. The first one regards to Senate Bill 40. It clears up a little confusion the citizens may have regarding when, unfortunately, if their license is ever suspended or revoked. You can get suspended or revoked for a variety of reasons. Mm-hmm. Most likely, more than likely, if you've been involved in driving under the influence, your license might have been suspended for some time. Also, if you were an underage individual and you have a driver's license and you were caught drinking, you also might have your license. But either way, whatever unfortunate experience you had where your license was suspended or revoked, at the moment, it's difficult to, with working with the courts, so when does your actual suspension date start? And so what we're trying to do is look at the statutes that reflect those areas of driver's licensing, clean them up, and make sure that the date specific is outlined in the statute. So you, unfortunately, if you were suspended, you know when your time starts. And some people think, well, is it the time I show up in court that day when it is suspended? Is it the time I actually give it to the clerk? Or is it the time when I actually maybe turn it over to driver's licensing in my hometown? So those are the things we're trying to make sure they address in Senate Bill 40. So you know the exact date, the driver's licensing folks know the exact date, and certainly the court knows the exact date. So we're all moving at the same speed.
Right. Let's go back for just a minute before we go forward and back to the beginning and talking about wiretapping. Mm-hmm. What does that look like? You know, how do you wiretap a cell phone?
Well, it's part of that is some operational pieces that I'd hate to devolve.
okay, sure.
Okay? But you can bet the technology is out there, and a number of other states have the same type of technology working with your wire carrier, depending on who it is. And obviously the federal law enforcement also has this ability too. And remember, it's all garnered around a court order. The law enforcement just can't arbitrarily, you know, wake up on a Wednesday morning and say, I want to tap so-and-so's cell phone. That's not how the statute reads. And none of the changes that we proposed in Senate or House Bill 1028 wants to change the parameters of how you acquire such a court order. So the threshold is still the same. However, just say, let's for the scenario or the sake of this discussion is someone's involved or suspected involved in drug trafficking. How law enforcement came across that information could be a number of sources. Maybe in particular they already arrested an individual that was purchasing from that individual. Well, obviously one of the key components of how the drug supplier, the drug distributor, or the drug manufacturer, they're going to need to converse at some point on whether how to move this quantity of contraband from point A to point B, and then obviously get it sold to those individuals that want to purchase that contraband. They're using some sort of communication device. Back when the statute was originally enacted back in 1969, clearly the main communication choice was your landline phone. And so when they crafted that statute, that's kind of how, that's definitely how they crafted the legislation back in the day. So we just want to make sure that the legislation that's in place today, that we be able to ask the court and apply to the court, say, this individual we believe is engaged in a certain type of criminal activity, and we'd like to be able to monitor his or her cell phones. And the court, again, has the ultimate say. They decide one way or the other if this occurs. We need their permission. And from that point forward, there's severe, or there's restrictions and reporting requirements they have to relay back to the court regarding our activity as we monitor that individual's cell phone or other type of communication device.
My guest is Trevor Jones, South Dakota Secretary of Public Safety. Secretary Jones, in my mind, cell phone technology is inherently easier to access than a landline. How do you target your collection then to limit it to what the court order allows?
Well, it all revolves around what that original crime is and what you're looking into and what you've asked the court to give you authorization to monitor. The court dictates a lot of that, and you would relay that type of information in your application to the court. And then they would determine the parameters and where you might flow as the information goes back and forth.
Is there a back and forth then between you and the court, or once that court order is signed, that's something that you monitor on the law enforcement end?
Yes, primarily on the law enforcement end. Okay. I mean, I suppose the court could put in some parameters in there where they wanted to be updated a certain pace. I believe that's the case. So it primarily would fall to law enforcement. Clearly, they're the investigative side of the process. So they would be monitoring those, not necessarily sometimes conversations, sometimes text, sometimes images, sometimes just data of like how often the phone number is dialed from a particular phone or sure. accessed even, because you can have the access through the internet as well too.
Yeah. You bring 20 years of law enforcement experience before you were chosen as Secretary of Public Safety. I'm wondering what kind of, is all that experience in South Dakota, by the way?
Yes, exactly. Yep. It's all in South Dakota. I started out my career in 1990 with the Minnehaha County Sheriff's Office and haven't left South Dakota.
What kind of culture do we have as far as supporting law enforcement officers here in this state compared to what you hear throughout the nation?
We are very privileged here in South Dakota because the vast, vast majority of folks are very supportive of law enforcement, whether they be at the state level or at the local level. We're fortunate in that respect. I know in other areas of this, of America, they run into some problems in certain neighborhoods, and in certain states, we don't run across that very often here in South Dakota. We're thankful for that, and we hope it continues. And we want to do our best again. Even strengthen that bond between law enforcement and the community. So we're going to continue to do efforts to work with communities to make sure they feel a part of the law enforcement brethren. We want, obviously, the law enforcement, wherever they reside in a small town or big town or rural area, that they're a part of the community.
Hmm. New president inaugurated this week. President-elect Donald Trump has a different sort of dialogue about law enforcement than President Barack Obama did. What are you looking to sort of change, if anything, in a new presidential administration regarding law enforcement?
We're not really looking to change, per se. I mean, we're certainly curious to see what type of initiatives soon-to-be President Trump will passed through legislation or executive orders. So once we, you know, determine what those initiatives are, we will adjust accordingly and work well with our federal law enforcement partners to make sure we're secure in our community, whether it's a small community or the state itself. Sure. I think we'll just wait to see what he says.
The national FOP did endorse him, as did the state FOP, I believe, if I got that correctly. So are you optimistic about working with him as a president?
Yeah, we're very optimistic. I think with any of our Washington leaders, I think they always want to have the citizens' interests at heart, best interests at heart, and certainly so do we. So we just got to figure out what's the best way to partner with them, but at the same time, you know, keeping the state's sovereignty as well. It's just we have certain, I would say, priorities that might be a little bit different than the federal government, but there's always ways where we can maybe leverage each other's assets, resources, and personnel to make sure South Dakota's safe as can be. At the same time, we help America stay safe as well.
Trevor, we've got about 30 seconds left. Do you want to talk about sort of motor vehicle crash stats for 2016?
Yes, yes. We're very happy, you know, as you might have read at some point, that our crash fatalities on our roadways here in South Dakota are down, almost our lowest since 2011. And so we like to see that trend continue, and we want to give credit where credit due, because we think certainly that's part of that is law enforcement messaging through your chief's office, your sheriff's office, and your highway patrol. But however, I would give credit to the South Dakota driver. I think they're making good choices to obey the speed limit, to be, you know, very proactive, defensive in their driving to make sure that they're safe drivers as well. And hopefully we'd like to see this 2016 is to see some of the alcohol-related crashes continue to go down. One way we think we can do that is we have a campaign. If you look at DriveSafeSD.com, we have a new campaign out there which really focuses on, it was New Year's Eve that's just passed, then of course Super Bowl is coming up and March Madness, and those are some activities where individuals like to, you know, engage.
Trevor, we're going to run out of time, so I'm going to say thank you very much, and people go to that website. We'll put it up on our website as well.
Yep.
Appreciate your time, Trevor. Thanks.
DriveSafeSD.com. Thank you.